And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Good evening. And I say it that way because we're so close to Halloween. This is Martin Willis, the host of Podcast UFO, and welcome to the show. And we're coming at you live, like every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We have another fascinating show for you tonight. Alejandro Rojas of Open Minds is coming right up with the UFO news. And after that, our guest is David Paris, and he'll be talking about space warp technology, amazing stuff. And that will be a show that I think you'll find fascinating. And how are you doing out there, Alejandro?
I am doing great. Hello, sir.
Hello. And I saw when I was booking David Paris, I was looking online to see who else had him on, and it looks like you had him on.
Yeah, I've had him a couple of times. I think I've had him the most, and I've been following this his space warp stuff very closely. In fact, I told him I'm going to write a blog for the Huffington Post on his Indiegogo project, because I think it's fascinating.
It is, and you know, this may really show how it's possible for us to get to the stars and how the stars are possibly getting to us. So I'm into
how
it too.
How cool would that be? I mean, how cool would it be that, you know, like you and I got to talk to this guy and these gentlemen with great credentials who, you know, discovered and built a space warp technology in their basement, essentially. I mean, that'd be amazing.
It really is. How Dell computers started, you know, I mean, how a lot of,
yeah,
you know, just way off topic here, but, you know, the Apple number one, the very first motherboard ever made by Apple, just sold for just under $1 million at auction the other day. Isn't that something?
Yeah, and so, all on wood blocks.
Yeah, exactly. So speaking of credentials, let's talk about the news. I know we're going to start right off talking about Boyd Bushman.
That's right. Another gentleman with some impeccable credentials. He really is a Lockheed Martin engineer, a senior scientist there before he retired. He recently passed away August 7th. However, before passing away, he did a video that has gone viral and is making waves in mainstream media where he claims that there are aliens and UFOs at Area 51. Now, our story kind of chronicles his discussion in this arena over the years, because he actually, as far as I know, the first appearance he did talking about anti-gravity was on a 1999 documentary. That's where I first saw him. That was done by Nick Cook, who wrote for James Defense, the famous military magazine. And he was looking into black projects. He said no one, you know, he thought maybe there was anti-gravity projects out there, but no company said they had any, but this one engineer from Lockheed Martin would talk to him. Now, Boyd Bushman, this entire time, and even back here, his statements are really vague and kind of, you know, hard to understand. So Nick Cook was saying, well, maybe he's trying to tell me something, but he can't. But essentially, Boyd Bushman said he's interested in anti-gravity. Years later, in 2007, he did another documentary. Again, he talked about anti-gravity and how UFOs are most likely advanced aircraft mistaken for something else. But then at the end, you know, this is with David Sirita, kind of coaxed him, and he says he knew a jet fighter pilot who shot down the Roswell aircraft and walked inside and saw the aliens. So this is shocking. About a year later, you know, I was talking with a friend who in this field who said they knew Boyd Bushman, and they forwarded me an email that they had just received from him that was this polygraph test with these amazing claims that there are aliens at Area 51, that he worked at S4, that he knew Bob Lazar and all this stuff. And I couldn't verify whether or not it was real. Boyd Bushman sent me a cryptic email that just said, if you want to do an interview, tell me when and how much you want to pay me. And that's all I heard from him. So I did post that just this week, given this new information, because in this new video, he's showing these pictures of aliens. He's talking about, you know, an alien ghost picture he shows where this guy he knew supposedly was with this alien when it died. And when he took a picture of himself, the alien showed up in the picture. Some real wild stuff about good aliens and bad aliens and recently the aliens defending themselves and killing 19 people and really wild. It's kind of vague. You know, he's not really clear on all of these claims. But he says he wasn't at Area 51 in this video. He says he received it from a team that worked at Area 51. But some problems, obviously, there's a lot, have arisen in his statement. One being that actually he did some research. Those pictures he posted of this alleged alien he got from his team were posted by a guy named John Hutchinson, a Canadian anti-gravity researcher who Boyd Bushman had said he was interested prior. But in 2008, Hutchinson said he received these pictures and he from an unknown source who said they were in the CIA. He posted them, and immediately people said, hey, that's an alien from Kmart. I've got that alien in my office. And they started posting pictures. So now Boyd Bushman has said that these alien pictures were among his pictures he got from Area 51. And now a lot of people are saying, hey, that's my Kmart alien. So I think it's really – there are a lot of people saying, no, the alien looks a little different. It's close but not the same. Some people are saying, well, the government probably created that doll and sold it at Kmart in order to if the pictures ever came out, then they could debunk them.
Wow, that's a stretch.
Yeah, it's a really big stretch. So I think that unfortunately Mr. Bushman and probably John Hutchinson, who I think is a great guy, he's a very interesting researcher – I think they were both kind of fooled, but you know that shows that Mr. Bushman's pictures didn't come from Area 51; they came from a friend of his. So you got to question where all this information came from, and the rest of his claims, and why the heck is he claiming all this stuff?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple things that don't really sit right with me. Of course, the pictures right off the bat, but secondly, when you were conversing back and forth with him. And he wanted money, you know, to be on your show. That kind of, I don't know, that doesn't sit right with me. And he's a brilliant man. You can tell that right off the bat. And I did a little research, and the patents that they claim are his actually do go to Lockheed Martin and were credited to him. So he's definitely, you know, he's legit. But, you know, he might be one of these people that just went off the far end a little bit, you know, as they get older. And, you know, who knows the circumstances.
Yeah, it happens. We interviewed a guy named Dick French, and Lee Spiegel wrote about him, and that made a big story. But I feel that's the same thing. This guy's stories are inconsistent, even though he was a real Air Force pilot in the past. So who knows? Related to this, he said he knew Bob Lazar, and it just so happens I have been in contact with Bob Lazar because this is our other big news for the week. Bob Lazar is going to be speaking at the UFO Congress. So this is going to be essentially his first appearance at a UFO event like this.
Well, I was going to say he's been away from the whole thing for such a long time.
He's been away since the beginning. I mean, he came out. The only person he talks to is George Knapp once in a while. But otherwise, he shies away from this stuff. And just like he's done in recent interviews with George Knapp, he says, you know, I don't like being part of the whole UFO thing. I don't care if people believe me or not. And well, what happened was he came out for the anniversary, did another interview with George Knapp, and he kind of said these things. And so, you know, what we approached George with and George agreed is kind of like, well, let's get those hard questions people have out there, let you answer those and be done with it. So you can so it's going to be George Knapp is going to talk about his case. I saw this talk at MUFON. It's very compelling. And then he's going to bring out Bob Lazar and do an hour Q&A. And so this is going to be fascinating. Oh, but anyways,
I'm definitely going to be out there. And I hope I actually get to interview Bob. But, you know, I mean, I'm on the fence about him. I got to be honest with you, whether he's legit or not. You know, I mean, he did not speak the truth when it came to things like MIT and stuff like that. You know, I mean, it's pretty well covered that he actually didn't go there. And, you know, people say, well, maybe the government, you know, did something with his files and all that, you know, conspiracy type of stuff. But I don't know. Stanton Friedman looked really deeply into his education. And I'm on the fence about Bob Lazar, but I still would love to interview him.
I think I have similar feelings as you do. But really, George makes a lot of really great arguments. And so it's going to be really interesting to see Lazar address some of those issues. Because George does understand these problems very well. So he sees where these issues are. And, you know, he's a very hard-nosed investigative journalist. So he'll talk about that. But for what it's worth, I did ask Lazar, you know, if he really did know Bob Boyd Bushman. And he said, as a direct quote was, no, I've never heard of him. There were very few people who worked at S4, just a little over 20. We all knew the names on the list. He was not one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
so weird stuff. Yeah. I don't know what to make of it.
Right. So what's the last story for today?
Yeah, this one's really fun. This is a poll that was done recently by Ripley's, believe it or not, in London. And this was a poll as to, you know, if people believed in aliens and or God. And it was really interesting. They polled 1,500 adults, and 51% of these adults believed in aliens. Only 25% believed in God. When it came to the kids, 500 were polled. 64% believed in aliens. 33% believed in God. So it's kind of higher that are interesting that the kids had their higher rate for God. But still, yeah, this has been kind of a story that's been going out there in the UK that you know, the Brits believe in aliens more than they do in God. So that's kind of interesting, and I think it's just telling when it comes to how people feel about this sort of thing. And I do a talk on UFOs and religion and extraterrestrials, and it's almost like, you know, we're adopting kind of this nouveau tech-based religious belief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the more and more that there's awareness that there's most likely life out there, the more and more mm-hmm. people will believe, you know, that there's possibly aliens out there.
Yeah, you know. So really interesting story, I think.
And the God one, I wouldn't touch that one.
No?
Well, it's a tough subject that always gets people on. People are passionate on both sides of the fence on that one.
Don't be a wuss, man. No, I understand what you're saying. I like to feel that I'm agnostic is what I like to say, not straight atheist. But I do got to say that, you know, when it comes to people who believe some really wild stuff, whether it be UFO cases or extraterrestrial cases, I don't put much stock into. You know, if you're a religious person, you can't really persecute those people because your beliefs are based off of faith as well. So to me, it's all kind of faith-based stuff that I don't prescribe or subscribe to, but each one has their own right to believe whatever they want. And I think it's interesting that Corrado Balducci, who used to be the demonologist for the Vatican, he said, how can I discount their anecdotal information when my beliefs and my religion are also anecdotal?
Good for him mm-hmm. to say that. And I'm right there with you with the agnostic stuff. There I came out of the agnostic closet.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for joining us. And I knew you would one day.
All right, Alejandro, thanks a lot, and we'll be talking to you next week. All right, so right after the short music break, we'll be right back with David Paris, and you can jump in the chat room at podcastufo.com and interact and ask questions. We'll be right back. Well, hello, David Paris. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing tonight?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us. And I think I heard you on Coast to Coast or somewhere, and I was rather taken and fascinated by what you're trying to do. And this whole thing, I actually had a conversation going with Dr. Sonny White at Eagle Works, I think it was, about warp bubbles and stuff like that. This stuff all just fascinates me. So, first of all, can you introduce yourself, your background, and what you're up to?
Okay, my name is David Paris, and I'm an adjunct professor at four local colleges here, And I teach about 10 different courses from astronomy, physics, geography, geology, meteorology. I do a number of I'm kind of like this traveling science guy. And I do about 70 semester hours a year. So I'm very busy with distant education, face-to-face. And I've also have a company that we recently formed after about 3 years of, well, I guess it started really back 9 years ago when I got involved with the research on the Bruce Gernon case. And that had led up to a discovery of natural phenomena and then to take it into the lab and actually produce an artificial environment of a spaceport bubble. And in the last year, August of 2013, we formed a company of Space Warp Dynamics. And so we haven't sold anything yet, but we're in any basic free time that I have. I've been, you know, in the laboratory itself. I have a master's degree in geography, and I have an engineering associate in science, and I've been in the Air Force. I've written numerical weather models. I've had about 40 years into the defense contracting business and also as a private defense contractor, working with the Army in portable forecaster workstations. Mm-hmm. I guess it's my involvement in aviation, ham radio, electronics, software, numerical weather modeling. All of that came very nicely packaged in and under the geography header, which allows you to be cross disciplines and operate in any of the modes. And I prefer in that kind of realm, kind of work that I do. You have to be knowledgeable about a lot of different fields and be able to integrate those things together. I never wanted to ever be pigeonholed into a particular segment. Now, that doesn't mean that I reject people who are, you know, concentrated in their fields. That's not where I'm coming from. I just feel is that you really need, when you're working on a particular subject matter like this, is that you got to have a background that covers a wide vista of things. You would just be surprised on where ideas and experiences come from to solve this big detective story. And that's really what it's come down to. I mean, this is like a really intriguing detective story. Started back when I was 16, when I had my sighting of a UFO upstate New York in 1969, actually near the end of August. Wow. That's when we formed the company, all the ironies of it all.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about that. And Art Bell, probably, have you ever talked to him on your ham radio?
Well, actually, I'm not an extra class. I'm a general class.
Oh, okay.
So he actually has reserved frequencies for extra class that I'm not allowed to get onto.
Okay. You're speaking a foreign language to me, but that's okay. Can you tell us what the Bruce, I believe you said Gern case
Gernon.
Is?
Yeah. Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. In 1970, he was flying a Beechcraft A-36 Beech Bonanza. It was a brand new, several months out of the factory. And he had been making a number of flights from West Palm Beach to Andros Island. And he was doing this as a business venture. And his father was in realty, and he had another business associate. He was actually in construction. And they made a number of flights back and forth to Andros to West Palm Beach, about 14 of these things. And on one of the last flights that they had made, he got caught up in a series of thunderstorms, very rapidly developing thunderstorms, which circled his aircraft. And he was near the Bimini Island area, and he had to make a decision because these thunderstorms were up to about 65,000 feet, and the last two were kind of closing the door on his escape route. And as these things began to go up, he noticed a tunnel being formed between the two of them. He saw blue sky on the other side. And, the rule of thumb is you don't fly through tunnels like that because there's extreme turbulence. You could lose control of the aircraft. But he knew that if he allowed these clouds, or if he didn't penetrate and get out of this situation, that he'd probably run out of fuel and crash into the ocean. So he took the tunnel, and as he went through this, which was miles in length, within like 20 seconds, he covered well over about 10 miles of girth of these clouds forming up, and which was way faster than what he should have been able to do this. And as he exited this, he got encased in what he calls electronic fog, where visibility went to zero around his aircraft. The aircraft was still flying. This, quote, electronic fog, which is ionized particles that are formed from the clouds that adhere to the aircraft's surface because it's metal. He was in a non-sustainable mode, but he got caught up into a natural phenomenon of a local spaceport bubble. And this is as near as I can figure because it follows the theory and everything of Miguel Alcubierre. And he ends up in Miami Beach, but he disappears from radar, and he makes a radio call to the approach control, and they say, well, there's no aircraft at Bimini Island. However, we have an aircraft south on Miami Beach. And he says, it can't happen because I'm like almost 100 miles away. Why can't you pick me up on radar? And he goes, sir, there's only one aircraft, and that aircraft is down over Miami Beach. Well, the fog dissipates, and he is over Miami Beach. And this occurs about 2.5 minutes later. He then clears with the approach control. He lands. He had taken off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He lands at West Palm Beach at 3:47. Well, something's wrong here because he normally, and he had done these trips a number of times, this trip typically takes 75 minutes, and he actually had put an additional 40 miles onto his route, trying to avoid the thunderstorms and try to figure out what's going to happen. So he actually made this trip within 47 minutes. And so he lands, ground clocks, check with his ground clock or his clock inside the aircraft. And he is puzzled by this. But fortunately for us, Bruce is a very meticulous pilot. And I've flown with him several times, actually, as a result of doing other television programs with the History Channel and Discovery Channel and that. So we have met up several times, and I've interviewed him, and I've flown with him. Like I said, he's a very detailed kind of guy. Fortunately for us, he wrote down a lot of this information, and he also had the refueling tickets. He's one of these type of pilots that as soon as he landed, he would then refuel the aircraft. In this case, he found that he had 9 extra gallons of fuel that he did not expend. And he was, very meticulous about how much fuel do you use, what was his use rates and all these type of things. And so in order for him to have made that trip, I calculated that he had to be flying 319 miles an hour from takeoff to landing in order to traverse that distance. Now, problem being is that the wings of the aircraft begin to crack at about 220 knots, and you get structural cracks into the wing structures. So the plane's not designed to go 319 miles an hour, so that kind of was left out of the equation. And then we had to then consider at that point, as he has always said, is this time travel that I've gotten involved with? Because he states that, the hull began to rotate. There were cumulus clouds, small puffy Q inside that kind of looked like a cement mixer kind of going around. He also talks about feeling a little bit weightless and the aircraft operating in a kind of a hydroplaning mode prior to feeling the weightlessness. And it was momentary. And So with all the – and I kind of take this through in the science of the Bruce Gernon flight. I take it through the tunnel second by second as his explanations, and then make comparisons against Miguel Cubier's theories. And they seem to parallel quite nicely. Well, that led me to then do some further investigation, which I began to look at the weather forensics, aircraft losses in the region, and I started to compile all this information. Being a meteorologist, you know, I had access to all these type of things and began to find a pattern. And with that pattern, I was able to then do some predictive analysis of those patterns and then make predictions as to these types of thunderstorms that would evolve and be created off the east coast of Miami. And so you're at about 20 degrees north latitude at that point. So it's a very active area. There's tremendous amounts of water vapor, light variable upper air winds, and the availability of generating thunderstorms from 11 o'clock in the morning, peaking at about the 3 o'clock mode, or, you know, where they become very intense, is very common in that region. So pilots that take off in a nice clear sky will get wrapped up and involved in these things later on in the day as they fly out into the, quote, the Bermuda Triangle. And I use that with kind of a tongue-in-cheek. You could draw a trapezoid there if you wanted to. This triangle is not really a line of demarcation. Mm-hmm. You take off and you leave the coast of the United States in that region, that general area, and you can get involved in very rapidly forming open cell cumulus that goes to towering Q that then goes to very large thunderstorm. But in these cases, the thunderstorms that are generated are huge. They're just tremendous in girth, and that means the width of the cloud. And the thunderstorms can evolve and go up to, I've seen them on radar myself, well in excess of 70,000 feet out in those regions.
Wow. Could you explain to the listener what a warp bubble is, or theorized to be, I should say?
Yeah, that theorized. In the lab, we have found a little bit, some slight differences. However, the fabric of space, as talked about by Einstein himself, is that the entire universe is can be controlled in a sense. The fabric of space can be controlled by mass. And the larger the mass, then the more compression of the fabric of space, which is relative to other positions around and throughout the universe, and or our own solar system. So our sun, for example, has an equator, has a little bit more mass or kind of a bulge at the equator, just like the Earth does. And therefore, there's a slight, there's a little bit more compression. And we could relate this to an accordion, for example. Say an accordion stretched all the way out is representing normal space. If you get near a large mass in a natural condition, then the accordion would begin to get compressed. However, that same distance from the end, one end of the accordion to the other, is still the same amount of linear space, except it is just compressed. And the object here of what Miguel Cubier talked about in 1994 was the fact that he was looking at an artificial inducement of space that would compress in front of the craft, and then that compression would then begin to blossom out up and around the craft and then expand behind, pushing the craft through normal space. So kind of like if you want to envision a hot air balloon once it achieves its buoyancy, being able to be floating through the atmosphere in a sense. So you've got it kind of like a hot air bubble. Maybe a poor example, but a lot of people have a very difficult time thinking about this type of phenomena.
Now, is there any we have a couple of questions coming up on the message board, but is there any parallel between your work and what they were talking about at Skunk Works?
I'm not familiar with exactly what they were doing. There possibly could be parallels, but I am not aware of the various programs that they had going on. Actually, I kind of believe is what I had actually witnessed when I was 16 is more than likely the type of propulsion system that they utilized on that craft. I mean, that was the thing that really got me started. Actually, we have
another... Okay, so let's hear about that.
Okay. Upstate New York, a place called Goodyear Lake, late August, about a week before going back to school in my senior year. And that morning, I was up at a friend's house. We're looking up at the mountain and turning away and talking and joking around. And off the corner of my eye, I spotted a silver disc. And it was about 60 feet in diameter. It was approximately 100 feet off the top of the mountain, which later we revealed dug up a topo map, which was about 400 feet high. And it was so it would be about it would be about approximately 500 feet off the ground and about 1,200 feet downrange of us. And as it was only moving about 20 miles an hour at the most at that particular time. And as it passed our position, it banked about 20 degrees, and I could see the top of this thing, and I could see the metal striations. You know, as you know, like roll aluminum out, you know, when the manufacturer, there's kind of like an embedded, because of the rollers, there's like striations into the metal. Well, the sun reflected against this, which was to our back, and this is against a perfectly blue sky, no clouds at all. And you could see that there was a front and back to the craft, perfect discus-shaped object, platinum in color. And it was not rotating or any of this stuff. It was incredibly stable. And this thing, and if you're familiar with aviation, you'd appreciate this. When this thing banked 20 degrees at 20 miles an hour, a 60-foot diameter craft, it never lost an inch. You know, even a small aircraft like a Piper Cub, when you bank that aircraft, you lose altitude. Okay, there's different lift coefficients onto the wing at that point, and again, it's all thrust to weight ratios here. And in a normal horizontal flight, you know, you can keep it nice and level, but this thing didn't veer at all, and then it righted up after it passed our position, and it just went away. It went, and so that intrigued me to this very day.
How many people were with you, by the way?
There was about four or five of us.
Now, and before you move on, I just wanted to know, had you talked about it over the years with the same people you witnessed it with?
Yeah, I mean, over the before we all kind of separated and went our own ways after high school and then went to college and all this type of thing. Yeah. After that time, we did talk about it. We also tried to get the groups. It was a family, but to get the mother out so she would be in a witness. Because in the back of my mind, being 16, I was like, who's going to believe us, right?
Yeah.
And so when I went home and I told my parents about it, my father, being an old retired colonel in the Army, goes, what, are you crazy?
Yeah.
I've actually compiled a story that details a lot of this with the maps and the position of where we were and all that type of thing, and a picture of the house of where we were related to the mountain and all this type of thing. So I put a lot of work into writing this up because, to me, this was really the beginning. I mean, I was a football player and a wrestler. I dropped everything in my senior year, and I just started studying and trying to collect information and trying to hone all my skills because I was bound and determined to figure this out. Now, you know, was it 46 years later? I think I may have figured out how it worked.
Well, that's a question I have for you. I want to know, first of all, up on the message board, someone wants to know, what type of equipment do you have in your lab? And I wanted to know, have you had any breakthroughs on this in your lab?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's hear about it.
We've actually have held back for the last 3 years a lot of the discoveries that we've made because we have designed a number of confirming experiments that were different from the other ones. And as we kept getting the same kinds of answers coming back, we said, well, are we really sure? Isn't there another way to try to measure something like this? We'll do this experiment. And as a result, we kept getting more and more confirmation of what we were seeing was reality. And so we haven't really said anything and haven't, put this out into the public view, because then it gets a little scary of some of the other implications about it. But, I'm always I'm trying to look at this from a very positive mode of getting to the point of being able to actually lift the craft off the ground that we've been building. It's a quarter scale of a full-size version, 30 by 30 foot human occupied craft. 7 people could sit in this thing, but we have a 7 by 7, which is a quarter scale version of it, and it weighs approximately 40 pounds. And the motors that we've been developing our goal is to lift this thing off the ground within the next 6 months to a year.
Oh, boy, that's exciting.
With funding or without funding.
We'll talk about that, too, because you have an Indiegogo, mm-hmm. and let's talk a little bit about that. But first of all, if you wouldn't mind answering, what type of equipment do you have?
A lot of homebrew. I mean, you don't go down to the local store, electronics, I don't care, whatever kind of store you want to name, and you can't pick up any of this kind of stuff. So we've modified greatly a lot of the basic equipment. Now, we happen to be using an RF-based transmitter with linear amplifiers, and all these things are modified. We have a very special fractal arrays, and if people want to go to the website, they can see pictures of it. And these are specially modified and tuned to, the frequency is really kind of irrelevant in many regards. But the bottom line is that what happens between these arrays as the compression of the fabric of space in the near field of the arrays themselves. And we've actually replicated is the tripole electric fields within thunderstorms. Now, one of the realities of Bruce's flight and a number of other pilots that, and many people would claim that, their accounts are very anecdotal. You know, there's not a lot of evidence. Well, how many people fly with all kinds of different digital recorders and all kinds of cameras with them when they're flying aircraft, right? Hmm. That doesn't happen normally. And we're fortunate, like I said, with Bruce being able to write down. He had the refueling tickets and the maps and all this other things. And that's what really kind of led me down into trying to figure this mystery out. And the bottom line was that the thunderstorms were the real elements here, and the fact that the thunderstorms themselves are kind of like a huge particle accelerator. They make antimatter. You got gamma rays coming out of these things. They got like 10 to the 15 watts of power, which is an incredible amount of energy in comparison to, say, for example, like a 13-kiloton weapon that would have about 10 to the 7th watts of power in equivalence. So you got a differential there of 10 to the 8th watts of power. I mean, that it's tremendous. Now, I say this, and then when you talk to theoretical physicists, they will claim that you have to have an inordinate amount of power. It has to be exotic energy and blah, blah, blah. And I respect what they are trying to do. However, we discovered that it doesn't require that. And this is where the controversy will go. But however, I will we will overcome that type of controversy with the lifting of the craft off the ground. And then there won't be any arguments about what we've done, what we've accomplished, and what we have gotten our patent pendings on. So now, like I said, we modify greatly a lot of the equipment that we use. We stretch our dollar greatly. Mm-hmm. I work an inordinate amount of hours to put this towards that. the team that we've assembled. We have two physicists with us, and we have a flight test engineer. We have software people. We have system designers and fabricators and that. And no one gets paid. And oh. we've been together now for 3 years, and we just recently took on a new physicist, a particle physicist, actually. And some of the software that he's developed for some of the places that he's worked, the experience that he's gained, he thinks that he can adapt the concepts of what he's done with a brand new base of software that will take the data that we have generated and be able to display it in a three-dimensional mode for us. So that's one of the things we really want to see. Now, we have our equations that we've developed that will predict how much pull that this motor has. And again, it may be a little bit to describe here onto the podcast here, but the motors, if you take your hand and form a V between your thumb and, you know, your fingers, and just open up your hand, form a V, this thing doesn't thrust, it pulls. In other words, things go in towards it. And so we have a torsion bar that we've set up that's over 3.5 pounds of weight in an isolated case, and it's insulated. It's made out of glass and wood. And we have put the motor 35 centimeters away. We have put it 70, 140 centimeters away. And we can swing that weight. And we have swing rates, which are per minute or millimeters per second. At 35 centimeters, for example, it goes like 1.56 or 1.5 millimeters per second. Now, to the audience, that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you see that laser reflecting off the mirror onto the projection screen, and this thing was sitting dead still, and then at 140 centimeters, you see the thing swinging again. That's 3.5 pounds of weight with 100 watts of power coming out of the motor. And so our motor evolution, we've had, I have 10 different variants of this motor. Each one is stronger, and with the same input, we've been able to double the capacity of the motor. And the new one that we're testing, this particular motor hasn't been put into the vertical test stand yet. In another few days, it will be. But the hope is, from what I'm seeing right now, is we might be able to get it again to double the output with the same input. And this is what we're leading up to, is about 2,300 to 2,400 watts of power. We should be able to lift about 100 pounds off the ground. And then it goes off kind of asymptotically. In other words, once you've established the over-unity type of condition, it doesn't require a whole lot more power. And this kind of correlates back to what I seen when I was at 16 years old, is that being in a horizontal position and moving, it doesn't require, and that's what it appeared to me. It didn't appear that it required that much more energy for this thing to just take off like a shot, which I think that this particular UFO, which has been seen all over the world, there's pictures of it from 2001 in Budapest, Hungary. It's the same craft that I saw when I was 16. So the evidence is out there that this craft has been around. Now, did somebody here on Earth produce it? Well, I don't know if I can answer that, because I am not knowledgeable of everything that goes on behind the scenes and Skunk Works and other places around the world. But to be quite honest with you, if we had it in 1969, wouldn't you think that we would have that now?
Yeah, I think that came up in a couple of podcasts ago when I was speaking with Lee Spiegel about something that people are talking about exists now. And he saw that way back when, you know, same type of deal. It couldn't be held secret that long. I mean, I wouldn't think it could be.
Well, if you have individuals like Kelly Johnson, who was the head of the Skunk Works, and he had a sighting of a craft, a dark craft, that was kind of triangular in shape, if I recall the story correctly. But he had an encounter, and he had an observation. And yet, you know, he designs then the SR-71 Obviously, he had a whole litany of aircraft that he was, you know, key guy on that developed and flew. But one would think that if he actually had that sighting and was impressed by it, that they weren't doing anything at that point. And if there was anybody that was going to be doing stuff like that, I would kind of imagine that if there were government research labs, they would have been tried to got him to develop a craft around the engine technology. But that's speculative on my part, and I usually like to only make statements that I can back up with fact. But that observation of Kelly Johnson was quite intriguing to me. In a sense, was that just a story to cover up something, or did he legitimately have the sighting of which has been stated and documented? I would have a tendency to believe him more than other people, not just because he was an engineer, but I've seen a lot of interviews with the guy, and he seemed very, very down to earth, you know? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I guess we can all have secrets. Yeah.
Now, are you? Is anyone reaching out to you since you've been talking about this and giving you their feedback? Any type of scientists in the field that have an interest in this, or are you kind of solo and bringing people in on your own?
There really hasn't been any interest from the outside scientific community. We're going this alone. We realize we're up against. We're going against, in some respects, the energy levels, and that's been a big point of controversy. I go down several different theoretical physicists that have, you know, made their statements, and it really doesn't bother me because I'm going in my own direction. So the facts that we have are the facts. It works. It's there. It does what it's supposed to do. Here, I'll put you this way. You cannot compress a laser beam within a near field of an RF-generated environment. You can't compress a laser beam. We do. And we have the data from different experiments that all correlate the same thing. We ran 140 points with the laser, with the system off, and the system on. And with those 140 points, we achieved a sigma 4. Now, in order to get a sigma 5, if you've been, you know, reading about CERN with the boson and all that, they ran like 10 million points to get a sigma 5. We just needed another 4,000 points to get a sigma 5. And I wasn't going to eat up that kind of time because we're not a research lab. You know, we're trying to apply what we've learned and make this thing work. So I felt sigma 4 was good enough for us at this point. But the compressing of a laser beam is quite significant. And the next part of this, which then also goes to compression of space, is that we discovered that we have a redshift that goes into the motor. Now, we could correlate this to the effects of like a black hole. As you approach the fabric of space to a black hole and you get near the event horizon, the fabric of space would begin to compress, but it also exhibits the characteristics of a redshift. Now, with that said, the next point of this would be, well, how can you prove that you're adjusting the fabric of space? What's the reach or the fetch of this motor? And that's why we set up this modified Henry Cavendish experiment, where the torsion bars in an isolated case, there isn't any static electricity. There isn't any kind of electromotive force here, but this torsion bar, when the motor is positioned at a variety of different distances, but positioned so that it is accessing the end of the torsion bar, which are, you know, like I said, these 3.5-pound massive weights there, and this thing begins to pull towards the motor so that the motor does not thrust, it pulls. And so somebody's going to have to come up and then explain to us with all the results that we have is that everything that we've experienced is totally bogus. And I'm going to tell you is that they're not going to be able to discredit what has happened here, what we've discovered. We've also discovered which was also another interesting point. We know that you just can't generate just one big, huge bubble. And a lot of the theoreticians talk about one big bubble, 1,000 meters big, and all this type of stuff. And with the exotic energy, we discovered that you can make a larger bubble from multiple sources. And we've also figured out how to steer this thing. So Alcubierre had a big problem in that, in his theorizing of this, is you go straight in a straight line. Well, that's not entirely true. This thing is affected by mass. Gernon went in at 10,000 feet, and 100 miles later, he came out at 10,000 feet, and 100 miles later, he came out at 10,000 feet, which meant that the mass of the Earth influenced the bubble. And this means that if you go out into space with this bubble, it means that if you're not into a neutral point when you start to drive out of the solar system, you may be influenced. And again, there's some unknowns there because we haven't obviously done that. But in the lab, we've been able to put multiple engines together and power one engine up more than the other, and we can get it to turn on its axis. So axial control was a big consideration in the design of the Bluebird. With the multiple engine pods that we have, one on each wingtip and one prior back of the cockpit area. And that will generate a bubble that we can then control and articulate the motors inside the pods to allow full axial control of the craft. So we're very excited about that. And we have our power results and made comparisons against the ion drive thrusters that are out there. And we made a comparison, and you can see that in our paper that's presented on the Spaceport Dynamics website. There's a comparison of the Dawn spacecraft and their velocities of what they achieve and what we've achieved with 100 watts of power. And it's quite remarkable, the significant differences. An ion drive engine is the equivalent of what they're using now on the Dawn spacecraft, is the equivalent of like holding a piece of paper in your hand. That's the amount of thrust capability that it has. And it's cumulative. And right now, they're the fastest spacecraft without any kind of gravitational assist. And that's like 26,700 miles per hour. Now, it's taken them about 4 years to do that. And using their same specific impulse characteristics, so all the same criteria that they would use with the ion drive, we did this with our 100-watt unit. And that was an older engine, by the way. And at 52-minute mark, we're at 10.26 newtons of thrust. Well, equivalent, okay? This would be, for us, a pull and an equivalent velocity because we're traversing distance. And again, this is a concept that a lot of people have a lot of hard time grasping. But our equivalent velocity at the end of a 4 year mark would be well over 3 million miles per hour. And with the new motor, that actually works out to be almost double that. Like we'd be in excess of 6 million miles an hour with the new engine that have tested. And that's old stuff, because we have a new motor. And like I said, every time we have a new iteration of it, it's better and better and better. So that's our ultimate goal. But we kind of made that comparison so that people would begin to realize is that this isn't horseplay. This is serious stuff. And that what we have achieved at these low power levels far exceed what the abilities of the Xeon-based ion drive spacecraft are. And we'd love to get an opportunity to stick one of these things into space just as it is, you know, with the technology that we have evolved and developed. We could run on batteries. And that's the nice part about this. So we could run solar panels. We can run on batteries. We don't use any fuel. So,
which is amazing. Now, is there anything on YouTube? This is another question up on the board. Anything on YouTube people can look at to see any of your progress or anything in action?
Well, actually, if you go to the Space Warp Dynamics website, there in the lower right hand side of the first page there's a little tab or a button that says YouTube videos, and you can see kind of a narrated piece that I do, and it shows the experiment of the torsion bar being pulled by the motor. And I have to say, is my, you know, television and production and all that kind of stuff is, I did a little bit of that in high school as a kind of a hobby, but we are not professionals. So mm-hmm. You have to give us a little bit of quarter on that, of our production and capability. But I think we get the point across. You see the motor, you see the isolated cage, and we're all of this stuff is taking place into a Faraday cage. Number one is that all, you know, stray emanate of the signals, because we didn't know what we were really dealing with. We didn't know the biologic hazards of this thing, if there were any. And so we've actually made measurements of our, I have a Geiger counter, digital, and also handheld type, old styles. And with the digital, we had seen at 100 watts a half of microrem. And to let everybody know what that is, there's 1,000 micrograms per rem, which is a very low amount of radiation. The background is probably 12 to 18 microrems. That we experience on a day-to-day basis, natural uranium in the soils and the wood and brick and things like this. Sometimes it can get a little bit elevated, but we're talking a half a microgram of what we measured in the throat of the engine. So with that said, we still don't quite understand what would be the ramifications if you're getting wrapped up into the fabric of space, being compressed and released, how that affects us on a cellular structure. But I can assure you that we're at this juncture, with the Faraday cage, we have meters outside of the cage, and all of our meters are reading zero. And so we feel pretty comfortable in the sense that of what we have, purposely investigated to see for our health. No one's gotten sick, and we've been doing this for years now. I suspect that that we're fine.
Well, we're right at the end of our show here. Can you give out the name of your website and also how someone can find you on the Indiegogo fund drive you have going?
Sure. The Indiegogo fund drive, if you just type in Space Warp, it will take you right down into that particular segment. The websites that we have are Paris Space Warp Research.org. That'll take you to the base website that we established. But what you see is actually kind of the as we have gone along from the beginning to where we are right now, and you'll see buttons in there that reference to the Space Warp dynamics. And there's actually an independent website for that as well. Just type into your search engine Space Warp Dynamics and it'll pop right up. Or just type in my name and it will come up.
All right. Well, hey, thanks so much. We have to go for right now. And so that's it for our show today. And you can catch this podcast and any other podcast on our website, which is podcastufo.com. You can also check out the links and the stories in our show notes, as well as joining in the conversation in our forums. I want to give a quick thanks to everyone out there for helping out. Keith Rowland, producer for Dark Matter Radio. Of course, our guest, David Paris. We have Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse and Suivac for music they provide. And Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook. And guess what? Our Facebook page hit 20,000 while we were on the show here. How about that? 20,000 likes. And you can check us out live next week right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Wednesday. And everyone have a good week, and we'll see you later.